Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to Flow Guitar Enthusiasts with Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Great tone. Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players, as we explore tone and the gear that gets it.
Tonight on the Flow Guitar Enthusiast, we welcome Andy Babuk, author of great books such as Beatles Gear, The Story of Paul Bigsby, and most recently, The Rolling Stones Gear. Andy also owns a great vintage shop called Andy Babuk's Fab Gear. Flow Guitar Enthusiast is proudly sponsored by Sweetwater Musical Instruments and Pro Audio at www.sweetwater.com. And tonight's show is brought to you in part by Reverb.com, the marketplace for used, vintage, and rare guitars, basses, and other musical instruments. Now here are your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the show, to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show. Scott, how are you doing this week?
I'm doing good. I just got done shooting last night. I shot my Audio-Technica condenser mic shootout, so it's five different mics, all the way from the Pro 37, which is like a $60 mic, all the way up to their 40 series, which are some higher-end mics. So it'll be really cool to hear. I did it on two different guitars. I used my D28, and then I used the OM28. So on the D28, I did picking, kind of country, you know, chord and big chords, and then on...
Did you use your Gretsch?
The Gretsch? No, acoustic.
Oh, acoustic, okay.
And then on the... I did finger picking with the OM28, so that way people can kind of hear the difference between those mics. So it'll be cool. I'm really anxious to hear it myself.
Me too. Those are cool guitars anyway.
I shot it last night, finished it about 1:30 at night, so I actually haven't heard everything yet, so I couldn't tell you what my favorite is, but...
Yeah, no, I'm anxious to hear that. Scott had brought in he had gotten a D28, and it's just a beautiful sounding guitar. It's amazing. It's just really a sweet sound. So anyway, I'm jealous.
And then I'll have the videos up of Bruce Kulick from last week up pretty soon too. But this week I'm shooting a ton of videos, so I'll have a lot of stuff coming. I'll have a Shure wireless demo coming up, and then I'll have. Other things, maybe even my Univibe shootout I'm hoping to do.
That'll be fun. That should be good.
But what have you been up to?
Well, I got my Celestian Blue. I have the speaker. I haven't put it in the cabinet yet, but I have it all set up now. And the reason I got that is so that we can check out some smaller amps, because it's a low wattage speaker, but it's the sweet one that everybody wants. And actually, some of the amps we'll be talking about tonight, that was their featured speaker. So I'm real excited about that. That's kind of cool.
Yep, absolutely. Well, you know, one thing I wanted to mention, we mentioned earlier that Reverb.com is part of the show here today. So for those of you that aren't aware, they're an online marketplace that sells used vintage and rare guitars, basses, and amps, percussion, and effects. It's called Reverb.com. It's similar to a place where you can sell your stuff online, kind of like other websites, but mm-hmm. much cheaper. So you can sell it yourself or you can buy anything there. There's all kinds of unusual things that we'll be hearing about from our guests tonight, from the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. Like I saw quite a few original Maestro Fuzz boxes, which made the song Satisfaction famous. There was even Harmony Stratatones, which were Brian Jones' first real guitar, and then there was even some Framus basses from Bill Wyman. So I was pretty excited to see what all kinds of cool stuff they had in there that I was reading about in Andy's book. What did you find out?
There was some interesting stuff on there. I found, which I've never seen before, it was 1965 Vox AC50 head. It looked pretty cool. I've never seen a 50 water. They had the Super 30, the Super Twin AC30, which is the two-piece. It had the separate head, the AC30 head, and the cabinet. And it had this, like, tubular chrome tube frame that you put the cabinet was mounted on so you could tilt it. Same thing with the Super Beetle amps that they had at the time. So you could actually tilt the speakers up, like, you know, the Fenders used to lean them back. Anyway, that amp, they had one of those on there, which I thought was kind of interesting. Its price was $49.75, but that's a cool little amp. And then they also had an AC15, wasn't technically a Beetle amp, with two tens. Never saw that before. And it's like, you know, the Fender equivalent would be like a Vibrolux. But it had Weber Blue Pup speakers, which are basically like the Celestian Blues, and it was only $1,400. It was pretty cool. I saw Country Gentleman 67, the one with the painted F-holes was the one that George Harrison used, and there was a bunch of those on there, and actually fairly reasonable. I saw one for $2,500, one for $2,400. I saw a Beetle Bass for $2,495, and I found a D28 on there for $1,889. Now, this is all used. And this is basically private collectors putting that. But one of the Gretsches was actually the guitar used in Beatlemania, which I thought was kind of apropos.
Yeah. It's a cool website. I mean, you can buy everything from wiring harnesses to guitars. And heck, and if you want to, you can buy a 1960 Les Paul Burst if you want. It's on there also. So
might as well. For $250,000?
Yeah, it was. It was $250,000. So check them out, reverb.com. So,
yeah, it's a very cool site.
Let's take a quick break, and we'll be back with our guests.
Okay.
Hi, this is Aaron Raby, your resident guitars and amps geek at Sweetwater Sound. 1-800-222-4700 or catch us on the web at www.sweetwater.com. Sweetwater is proud to partner with The Flow in bringing you the latest and greatest in all guitar-related things, be it tone, be it artists and musicians, their secrets on their tone, amplification, and live performance. We at Sweetwater are just as passionate as the folks on The Flow in bringing you what we consider to be the best in pro audio equipment and guitar and PA gear. Give us a call and we'll discuss gear whenever you like. The number here is 800-222-4700. And again, you can catch us on the web at www.sweetwater.com. I'm Aaron Raby, and thanks again for listening.
All right, everyone, you are listening to Jeff and Scott on the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, and I'm Paul Reed Smith from PRS Guitars, and that's kind of what's going on. Enjoy the show.
All right, everyone, I want to welcome Andy Babook, author of The Beatles Gear, Rolling Stones Gear, and The Paul Bigbee Story, and in a new band called The Empty Hearts Band, which we'll hear more about later. Welcome, Andy.
Well, thank you for having me, man.
Really appreciate you having you come on. So I guess the one thing I want to ask you is what drew you to those iconic bands like the Beatles and Rolling Stones? I mean, everybody's got their favorite bands, but what is it about those guys that made you become so passionate that you wrote books and became a worldwide expert on them?
Well, when I was a kid, I had two older sisters, and they were into the Beatles, and so, you know, you just a little kid, you're influenced by that. That was popular music at the time. And it just, I could distinctly remember watching the film Help and then telling my parents after. I was like a little snot kid. I want to grow up. I want to be a Beatle when I grow up. And I didn't understand as a kid that, like, you couldn't grow up to be a Beatle. But as a kid, you probably thought you could. And I remember my mom trying to explain to me, well, you can't grow up to do that. I couldn't understand why you can't just do that. So here I am years later. Yeah, look at me now, right?
Well, hey, I mean, I think in your own way you've accomplished it for sure.
Well, I mean, you know, it's been a long, fun trip. And you know, it's a great honor to do a book, something like Beatles Gear or Rolling Stones Gear. You know, work directly with a band that really influenced you. And then when they receive the book, they actually really enjoy it, and they actually look at it as a, you know, historical document as opposed to just a, you know, some another knockoff book, you know. So to me, that was a great honor.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I should say for anyone that hasn't seen these books, and I assume the Beatles book is similar to what the Rolling Stones written, it's really cool because it's like it's a history and a total, you know, timeline of the band down as detailed as it gets. But then it's like when you mention one piece of gear, not only do you just mention the gear, then you go into like, you know, a couple paragraphs about the company and how that particular item was created and the popularity of it. It's crazy. I don't even know where you found that detail. I mean, how did you find that sort of stuff, like for those radios that they were using, the Rolling Stones were using in the very beginning?
Well, you know, it's kind of my forte. That's my expertise. Vintage equipment is you know, that's I know more about that than I do of anything else. So, you know, that coupled with the passion of the band, I wanted the books to be like a story of the band, but from the viewpoint of like the musician. So if you just like the Rolling Stones or the Beatles, but you don't really know much about equipment or guitars, you don't have to be a musician to read the book. You read it and you actually learn about things, you know, like you or I would think, you know, talking about Leo Fender is very common. Everybody seems to know that. Well, if you're just a Stones fan or a Beatles fan and you pick up this book, you might not know about Leo Fender or about the history of Gibson or Gretsch or whatnot. And so it kind of gives you an overview so you could get a real good feel on, you know, what the instruments were, where they came from, what's the history of it, and how the band ended up with them, too.
Now, when you decided to write this book, how long did it take to write the Beatles book, and what kind of inspired you to say, hey, this book needs to be written?
I worked in a guitar store for a real long time before I owned my own guitar store. And, you know, I was in a band for years called the Chesterfield Kings, and we've always tried to emulate the sounds of all the cool bands in the 60s that we liked on our own records. And, you know, we'd buy Hofner basses and Rickenbackers and Gretsches and, you know, cool guitars, Vox amps, stuff that like they used to use. And we found, you know, I found there was more to it than just the equipment. There's recording techniques. There's a lot to it. So I really got into it. And as I said, my passion is, you know, vintage guitars and just cool guitars and amps and stuff in general. So I seem to know a lot about it. And when guys would come in off the street and they'd want to buy, like, you know, they'd come in and they say, oh, yeah, I want to get a Vox Super Beetle like the Beatles used in the studio when they recorded. And I said, well, they didn't really use the Thomas Organ stuff. They used the Jennings Tube stuff in the studio. No, I know all about it. And you'd almost get into arguments with people. And the guys that I used to work with, they'd laugh about it. They'd say, oh, another Beatle geek, huh? And one night I remember they were all laughing that, you know, some guy was driving me nuts about, like, you know, some know-it-all about Beatles stuff. And the guy I was working with, this guy Steve, he said, you know, Andy, you should just get like a case of beer and lock yourself in your home for the weekend and write down everything you know about Beatles equipment. You'd probably have a book. And I go, wow, I never thought of that. So 6 years later, I owe that guy a punch in the arm because it took me 6 years to write the book.
It's a lot of beer.
Unfortunately it wasn't that kind of a ride. No, it was a lot of work, but it's a real Sherlock Holmes detective story. You know, I really enjoyed doing it.
Yeah, so I mean, how does that, I mean, did you interview some of the living members, or did you find producers, engineers? How did you find out the detailed information other than looking at pictures and things like that?
I interviewed hundreds of people, you know, even down to other Liverpool bands that were playing at the time, because to get a real feel of, you know, what was a band doing? How did you get equipment? You know, they played at the Cavern. We know all these stories, but, like, you know, what was it really like? Like, where'd you get your gear from? You know, so it was really interesting to get all the different viewpoints. And then, you know, eventually chasing down the band and getting permission to photograph their stuff. I mean, it was a laborious task, you know, and like I said, that took 6 years. The Rolling Stones gear book took 9 years. So, wow. You know, nobody pays me to stay home and just write books. So, you know, you're doing it as a labor of love, really.
Well, it's an amazing book. I mean, it's definitely, I mean, you can see that there's 9 years is clearly obvious in this book. I mean, it's like, what is it, 600, 700 pages?
It's under 700 pages.
Yeah, it's big. I mean, plus the Rolling Stones played for a lot longer, or are still playing a lot longer than the Beatles. So
50 years versus roughly 10.
Yeah, so there's quite a bit of stuff to document there, for sure. Which, actually, I was pretty excited on the Rolling Stones book. I've seen them twice, and I saw them at the Hollywood Bowl when they played here recently, not the original time. I'm not that old, but I wasn't lucky enough to be there around for that. But then I saw them at Dodger Stadium, and I saw Ron Wood play a pedal steel. My dad is a huge pedal steel guy, and I was always trying to figure out which pedal steel was. And sure enough, like 3 pages to the end, there's a picture of his single Emmons pedal steel.
Well, he had a bunch, but, you know, they were really kind and allowed me to actually go through and rummage through all their equipment. Once they understood that, you know, this was a historical document that I was trying to compile and really do a real credible piece of work, they really understood that my motives were genuine and sincere. They really opened up their doors. You know, Keith let me go through all his guitars. We photographed them. I was very fortunate to be able to play a lot of them. It was really great. You know, so Ronnie Wood had some beautiful stuff. You know, that Zemaitis guitar that he has, way cool guitar. You know, yeah. We found out a lot of things about the equipment that, you know, people just don't know. I mean, that, for instance, that Zemaitis guitar, everybody thinks it's a solid body, the black famous disc top guitar that he has. It's actually a hollow body filled with cotton.
Oh, wow.
Really?
Yeah. It's cool. You know, little things like that just really freak me out when you get to, you know, see stuff and actually find out cool details that you wouldn't know unless you were holding it. You know what I mean?
Filled with cotton. Could that, I mean, it's a stupid question. Could that catch on fire?
Well, I've heard of people using like acoustic guitars to reduce the feedback, stuffing them. Especially like 335s or the jazz guitars. I've heard of that before.
Well, this guitar is interesting because it's not much thicker than a Les Paul. It's actually might be a hair thinner. And but Tony Zemaitis had a really weird building technique. You know, he's a very eccentric guy. And, you know, like, for instance, that guitar, Ronnie Wood wanted it to be a bolt-on neck. And Tony just doesn't build bolt-on necks. He just, you know, he just didn't want to do it. So he built it as a set neck. But as a joke, he put a, you know, a plate on the back with four bolts on it, like a Fender style bolt on thing. And he actually had the back engraved with a like a pirate skull smiling. And the joke is that, you know, it's a joke that it's not a bolted on neck, but Ronnie still thinks it is.
Andy, I was talking to we were talking about different stories that we had heard, and Scott had talked to me about how the fuzz tone that was used on Satisfaction had come about, and it was originally a horn part. But I was telling him about Street Fighting Man, where they were taught the he basically recorded his acoustic guitar through a cassette, and they liked that sound so much they literally just laid that down onto the main tape. I have a question for you because I'm really curious. They did get some very, very interesting sounds. What did they use on the original recording of Jumpin' Jack Flash? Because I think there's a 12-string in there, and some of the other guitars. Is that in the book what they used on that?
Yeah, it is. But you know, here's the problem that you run into when you interview guys. You know, you're talking about years and years ago, and a lot of times they just don't remember. You know, and that's why I would divert also to like engineers that were there. Sometimes they remember, sometimes they don't. You know, to a lot of people, it's just a guitar. They don't know which guitar. It's, mm-hmm. They might discern whether it's an acoustic or electric guitar. It's kind of weird. Even like the one guy I really honed in on was Bill Wyman. I was very fortunate. Bill actually had me come over to his house in London, and I spent about 4 hours with him interviewing him. Really great detailed thing, because he was the, you know, the band historian. He actually kept a diary the whole time from 62 on.
Oh, wow.
So I figured he's going to be the guy that's going to know, because the other guys are just not going to remember. And I went to his house with my computer. I had some 450 images we sat with in chronological order and went through. And it would spark his memory a lot, but they just don't remember a lot. You know, it's kind of like the thing with McCartney. You know, when asked, you know, what kind of strings did you use, you know, on the Beatle records? And he said, long, shiny ones. You know, I mean, they kind of know, but they kind of don't. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you never want to get them on a spot where, like, you're really grilling them so hard they're, like, just get pissed and, you know, cut you loose. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that I can see that happening.
Yeah.
Well, with the Beatles, if you had, like, one iconic guitar and maybe one iconic amp, what would you choose that kind of represents the Beatles? Or you would say, that's the guitar I'd want to have and the amp I'd want to have that's Beatles?
Well, you know, it's really tough. I mean, I love them all. I think the most iconic look of the Beatles, you know, I think this is the thing that hits everybody's memory of how, you know, everybody envisions the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. You know, when you saw that, it just freaked kids out. You know, you got to remember, in 1964, the shopping list for your regular band that was like a garage band doing surf music or something, it was typically a Fender or a Gibson guitar and probably a Fender amplifier, maybe an Ampeg. But that was your shopping list. You know, most bands, that's what they had. And literally, you know, February 1964, this band shows up on TV with, you know, these mop-top haircuts, cool matching suits, Beatle boots. And they have this drum set, and it says The Beatles on it, Ludwig, right?
Right.
And then all of a sudden, they're playing a Hofner Beatle bass. You couldn't even buy a Hofner in the United States. They didn't really have distribution set up yet. It was German company. Gretsch was more of like a country western thing, you know, Chet Atkins. It wasn't considered a rock and roll instrument so much. And, you know, Rickenbacker, had it not been for the Beatles, they probably would have never survived, you know. I mean, so it was an uncommon instrument. Plus, they were playing this phenomenal music. So I think it's that image of the Beatles, those three instruments and that Ludwig drum set, that really is the, you know, it's the, those are the iconic instruments, I would say, you know what I mean? And then of course the Vox amps.
So what drew them to those different instruments? I mean, besides picking the standard Fender and Gibson stuff, I mean, was it just the location being in the UK, or were they just that way?
Well, it's really interesting because, you know, as a kid and growing up and, you know, being in my own band, I always thought there was some mystical, magical reason why they picked those instruments. You know, they were, you know, they're like the Holy Grail kind of, you know, that Beatle bass. It's like, wow, you know.
Yeah.
But after doing all the research for the book, and when I finally completed the book, I really took a step back and I go, wow, they were just a band. They were a damn good band, but they did what most bands do. You know, you go into a store, you know, he saw this Hofner, he figured, wow, if you flip it upside down, it could be left-handed and it'll actually look okay. So he ordered a left-handed version of the Hofner. It wasn't calculated. Another thing is and I got this from a lot of the bands in Liverpool, was everybody actually wanted the Fender Strat that was on the cover of the Crickets album, you know, mm-hmm. the Buddy oh, Holly yeah. thing. Mm-hmm. Everybody, that was the Holy Grail to all the British guys. You know, that you get a Fender Strat. But a lot of people don't know that there was actually a trade embargo in the UK, and you couldn't import an American-made instrument until late 1959. That's when it was lifted. So all these kids were playing European-made instruments that kind of looked like, you know, a Fender Strat. You know, John Lennon picked up his Rickenbacker actually in Germany, and George got his first Gretsch. It was actually it was a merchant sailor that brought it over in. You know, he bought it in New York and brought it to Liverpool and sold it in a newspaper, and that's how he got it. But generally speaking, you couldn't buy American-made instruments. Had you were able to buy American-made instruments, maybe they would be playing, you know, Gibsons and Fenders. You don't know. But it was more happenstance than anything else, really.
Well, what do you think made the Beatles sound so unique? Was it their writing, or was it their just genius in the studio?
I think it was a multitude of things. You know, all the planets aligned up perfectly for the perfect storm. It's, I think, of course, they really rehearsed a real lot. And everybody knows the stories and how they went to Germany and they had to play, you know, 1,000 hours a day. But, you know, any band, you get up and you got to play, you know, 8 hours every day. You're going to get pretty good just out of default. And they had a real great musical sense. I think also their vocals were, you know, phenomenal. They could do these three-part harmonies that sound like angels, you know. It was great. And they had a real musical sense. And then, of course, the writing capability of being able to write really good songs. And I think the other key of the Beatles that really set themselves apart from, you know, all the other bands, say, out of Liverpool, is they continued to progress. There was a lot of other good bands that made good music. You know, there was other bands, their peers in 63, maybe 64. For instance, Jerry and the Pacemakers. They had a lot of hits too, but they never progressed beyond 64. They stayed that same kind of band. The Beatles continued to stretch out and try to find new instruments and different kinds of sounds to put on their recordings. And I think that was really their true genius, that coupled with George Martin.
Mm-hmm. Question for you. In terms of their – when they were touring, this is a two-part question because I've heard about this amp and I've only seen pictures of it. When they toured, I think it was the second tour, Vox made them 100-watt tube amps. that they toured with? I don't know the model number.
Well, of course, the AC-100.
Was it the AC-100? Because it was like, I've seen pictures of it. It was a huge head,
a huge cabinet. The heads were about the same size as the AC-50, and there were various versions of it. A good friend of mine, Jim Ilya, wrote the definitive Vox book, and in there he goes through all the models. But, you know, they started out using AC-30s, 33-watt amp. Kids are screaming, girls are screaming. You couldn't hear yourself. So when I did the research for the book, Dick Denny, God bless his soul, was still alive. You know, he told me, you know, they would come back and they said, well, we need louder amps. So they came up with the AC-50, and it was a 212 combo, you know, like a cabinet and then a separate head, and they put a little trolley on it and stuff. And they used that, but still it wasn't loud enough. So, you know, back to the drawing board, we need something even louder. We'll double it. You got an AC-100. So it's a 100-watt tube head. But it's a 412 cabinet, but it's much taller than what you would consider like a Marshall 412. It's taller, so make the amp look ginormous, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here the Beatles in 1964, they come back to the United States and, you know, they could rule the world, and they're playing stadiums, and they got these unseen huge Vox AC-100s, and everybody thought it was like, you know, again, the Holy Grail. And they were British-made amps, so they were bringing them with them to do these shows. It was a culmination of all these different things happening at once that really just made them so special.
Now, I heard that I've talked to other people with amps, and the power transformer section of the amp greatly influences the sound. When they brought their amps over, were those British amps for 220 and they used a voltage converter? Because that would affect the sound, or did Vox make special amps for them that were 110?
No, the Jennings company, they were very swift, straight on with the AC-30s onward. They all had the voltage, you know, because you could switch them from voltage to voltage, depending on where you were. So those amps had that stuff built into them, you know.
Right.
Jennings was a really good company like that, you know, design-wise.
I had a question from one of our folks who listened to the show on a forum, and they wanted to know, what guitar did George Harrison use on the songs Words of Love?
Well, that's an interesting period, because George had just acquired the 12-string, which, you know, the British press, once Hard Day's Night came out, they dubbed it the Beat Boys' secret weapon, because you got to remember, that was a prototype instrument. Okay, the Rickenbacker was not making a stock 12-string. They had one of the first ones ever built. They brought it back, recorded all the great songs that would appear in the Hard Day's Night film, as well as the soundtrack and album. Mm-hmm. And then soon after, you know, they have the hits with that. They were back in the studio, so they had such great success with that guitar. You know, on the next studio sessions, that was an instrument that was used a lot. Simultaneously, John had ordered a Rickenbacker 12-string, but like his 325 three-quarter scale guitar. Okay, so it eventually showed up right before they went off to do the summer tour of 64. So, you know, when they're back in the studio, they've got these two 12-strings. So there was a lot of cool chiming stuff that they were doing with the dual 12-strings during those recordings. So that's pretty much the magical sound that you hear there.
Now, you have a new band coming out called The Empty Hearts, which is with Elliot Easton on guitars and Clem Burke from Blondie on drums, Wally Palmer from The Romantics on lead vocals and guitar, and then you on bass. Can you tell us about that band? And then we actually have a song we'll play.
Yeah, great. It's something I'm really proud of. And we formed a band. We're all friends. We've been friends for years, the four of us. And we just thought, how cool would it be to get in a room and start a band and think back to, like, remember when you were a kid and you picked up a guitar because you loved the Beatles and the Stones and the Kinks and all the other great bands? And wouldn't it be great just to, like, play music for fun and write songs? And that's literally what we did. We all got in a room and we just wrote songs together, and we're really good friends. And it kind of shows in the music and great musicianship, you know. Wally's a great singer. Elliot Easton, well, let's just say he's one of the best guitar players in the world. I mean, he's a phenomenal guitar player. You know, Clem Burke, killer drummer, and hopefully it shows in the music. We had a lot of fun recording it. We really did. And we're going to go out and tour and go out and play for people as well.
Well, the album drops August 5th here in the U.S. and then August 1st in Australia. So what is the track that we're going to play here? We're going to play up till the guitar lead.
Yeah, you got to hear that guitar lead.
What's Elliot, the name of the song?
Killing it. The song is called I Don't Want Your Love If You Don't Want Me.
Okay, let's play it.
That's a really cool song.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Now, how did you guys record that? It kind of sounds to me, I mean, at least I'm getting the impression off of the way the singer's talking. Did you guys record that as a band together and rather than doing separate tracks? And I mean, obviously separate tracks, but you know what I mean? Like, record it all together?
No, we cut it in a proper studio, but the producer, Ed Stasium, who co-produced it with us, he said, look, no, guys, you guys are a rock band. Get all in a room and I'm cutting you live, man. And you know, they divided, like, put gobos around the amps and stuff so it didn't bleed into the drum tracks. But it was the four of us standing in a room playing like a rock band, you know?
Nice.
I mean, like you're supposed to. So it was a lot of fun to do. It really was.
Can you tell me what everybody was using?
Elliot was using his Gibson SG. And he had a Marshall JCM 800 half stack, and he also had a Vox AC30 and probably another Marshall half stack. So he had probably three amps running all simultaneously. Mm-hmm. I was using an SVT with a Gibson, a 1965 Gibson EB2 bass.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
And, Clem was using, you know, obviously a full drum set. Wally, I believe, cut it with – he's got a Rickenbacker 1997 model, one of the British Rose Morris style, and he was playing that through a Vox AC30.
It's a nice sound. I mean, the tone is killer. No special effects, just straight amp and guitar?
Yeah, you know, listen, every time we rehearse or jam, and I just watch Elliot play while – you know, and it's weird for me because I'm playing the bass, but I kind of watch him. And he plays this stuff that just blows me away, and I just smile because he does it effortlessly, and I want to kill him because he's so freaking good, and he just does it like nonchalant. He's just so good. He's really killer player. I mean, and it's all tone. As you guys know, tone, you could get the equipment. You could get the right, you know, fuzz box, the right amp, the right guitar, and you could simulate a tone, but – 75%, probably a little bit more, is the finesse. The guy's playing and the way he attacks the instrument, knows when to lay back and lay mm-hmm. into it. And Elliot's just like a master at that stuff. I mean, and not just one style. I mean, we did a song on the record. It has like a country-esque kind of vibe to it. And we were working out the song, the arrangement for the song. And I just mentioned off the cuff to Elliot. I said, "Hey, Elliot, did you ever learn how to play? Do you play pedal steel by chance?" And he goes, "Nah, you know, Andy, I never really mastered it. I never took the time to learn it. But I think I could. Here, let me just show you this." Puts on a Telecaster, puts a compressor on, some treble boost and a compressor, and he starts playing this amazing guitar stuff that sounds exactly like a pedal steel. And my jaw dropped. I'm like, how the hell does this guy play like this stuff? This is one of the best things I've ever seen. So the new album is just, if you've, you know, obviously everybody's heard the Cars records. If you like what he played on this, this blows that away. It's phenomenal guitar playing, really, really good. And I'm not just saying that because, you know, I'm in a band with him. It really blew me away. He's a killer player. Killer.
Yeah, no, he's definitely one of the better guys out there.
One of the best.
Yes.
Now, I had some specific questions on the Rolling Stones book as I was going through that.
Sure.
And I kind of want to kill Jeff because he kind of alluded to it earlier. But can you kind of tell us a story about Satisfaction and kind of how
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I want to kind of kill you, Jeff. But anyways... how that actually was released, how it wasn't intended by Keith.
Well, you know, the song was kind of written on the road. Keith had this dream, literally had a dream, and woke up, and he would travel with a tape recorder by his bed, and he kind of worked it out in the middle of the night and went back to bed. And Andrew Lou Goldham told me, you know, who produced the records and was their manager. They went to Chess Studios. And they did a demo of it, what the band thought was a demo. And initially, there was no fuzz in it. Acoustic guitar, piano, there's a harmonica at the end of it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they cut at Chess Studios. And that was okay. They didn't really love it. Unfortunately, you know, I asked Andrew. No one knows where that tape is. It doesn't exist. You know, this has never been heard.
It's with the Jimi Hendrix stuff.
And then just shortly after that, like not even a week after, they were in RCA Studios. And they went at it again and tried to cut it again. This time, the Maestro Fuzz was brought in. And if you get a copy of the book, you'll see there's pictures of them actually recording the record. Keith actually used a Firebird 7. That's how he cut the guitar on there. So it's that with the Maestro Fuzz. And it was, you know, in Keith's mind, they didn't ever finish the song. They were still got to work on it. He wasn't, you know, he's trying to emulate a horn section with the fuzz. And then lo and behold, next thing you know, Andrew decided to put it out as a single, and the band kind of really didn't have a lot of say in it. And apparently Keith was kind of pissed that it came out without, you know, the band knowing, but next thing you know, it's a big hit. So he got over it pretty quick.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. It was really the song that catapulted the band into worldwide fame. I mean, that was the one song that worldwide just was – that was the turning point for the band.
Well, I mean, the other thing is that fuzz tone, I mean, kind of changed things too for the guitar world, because that's kind of like when people started hearing that, that's what inspired Mike Matthews' electroharmonics. It, you know, started creating – getting ideas in people to start making – little stop boxes.
Well, the box actually existed for a little bit, right? But it was never really utilized on a hit record, you know, a big national hit record, you know, worldwide, I should say. It was the first time an effects pedal was really utilized in a big way. And yeah, you could say that little pedal and that one song really changed the music industry, because every pedal was a thought of like, what else could we come up with? You know, what else could we think of? You know, what, you know, and then it just started a whole avalanche of bazillions of pedals, you know? So I always like to think that it's the one song, Satisfaction, that launched, you know, every crazy pedal that came after it, you know?
Yeah, that's true. I have a question for you, Andy. Doing both books, now we're talking about the Beatles and the Stones, and let's go back to around 1965, 66, where everything changed a lot, where the Beatles were doing Sgt. Pepper's, and even the Stones, they started stretching and getting into just, you know, different styles and stuff like Satanic's Majesty's Request and stuff like that. Did they interact a lot, or did they, from your, what you found in terms of research, were they influencing each other a lot? Because at that time, they were both kind of doing similar things musically.
Oh, that was a huge influence. They were watching each other. You got to remember that the Stones started, they got their huge break from the Beatles. You know, I Want to Be Your Man. Like, they did their first single, and, you know, Come On was pretty much a flop. You know, they, Andrew Luke told me that he had to really come up with, you know, a magic card. And he literally ran into the Beatles on the street, John and Paul, and he used to work for them. And so he said, "Do you have any songs?" And they gave him, you know, "I Want to Be Your Man." And then the Stones went in and recorded it. And because the Beatles were so huge at the time, everybody was curious, well, what, they're doing a Beatles song, that must be pretty good. And it literally got them on the map, got their foot in, got really the band to the next level. So from that point on, they would always watch each other, and they were very good friends and everything. But there's some cool instances where you could see equipment-wise where the relation, you know, George Harrison got the Rick 12-string, and as I pointed out, it was a prototype. Well, Brian Jones ended up getting a Rick 12-string soon after, okay, because the Beatles had one, the Stones got to have one. And they ended up using it. This is an interesting thing. The riff in Mother's Little Helper. You know, that riff. Everybody thinks it's like a sitar or something. In actual fact, it's a Rickenbacker 12-string played with a slide.
Oh,
that's
wow.
With that sound. Yeah, it's interesting. And it's actually Brian and Keith both playing 12-strings using a slide. They were trying to actually get an Asian sound, you know. So they say. So that was interesting. Another point was when we were doing the actual finite details, all the dates and stuff, it's really interesting. We found this article where Rubber Soul came out December 65, and the Stones got the record as soon as, Andrew said they got the record as soon as it came out, they got an advanced copy. They had it. And they were in RCA Studios here in the States recording when the record came out. So they played it, and they hear, you know, Brian hears Norwegian Wood and immediately sent out Stu, Ian Stewart, to go find him a sitar. So, and then he ended up using a sitar on Painted Black soon after. So you see how they influence each other, you know, with the equipment, you know. John Lennon got a Mellotron and used it on Strawberry Fields. Lennon got probably one of the first Mellotrons in England. He took delivery of it August of 1965, didn't use it until the year after, the end of 66, when they went in to record Strawberry Fields. Well, lo and behold, Jagger and Brian Jones both got Mellotrons and ended up using them on Satanic Majesty. So there's a lot of things that, you know, they were friends, but they would see one band do something, the other band would do it, and vice versa. So it was kind of cool that way.
Do you have an example of where the Beatles kind of copped from the Stones? Or was it always pretty much the Stones were copying from the Beatles?
There's more instances of the Stones copping from the Beatles, even down to, like, you know, Sgt. Pepper cover, Satanic Majesty's cover. It was almost like they were trying to outdo each other. I would have to say the Beatles were always setting the trend first. And it wasn't until, I'd say, the end of the 60s that the Stones kind of veered off and just went into a bluesier, different kind of thing. And the Beatles were doing something else, you know, so they kind of veered off. But up until like 67, they were kind of, there was a correlation there. You know, I mean, if you really study it and take a look, you could really see the similarities, you know.
Did they ever unofficially play on each other's albums?
Well, yeah, Brian played, you know, they asked Brian to come in and play White Album, and he showed up with a saxophone. You know, Brian Jones, you know, the guitar player, but he'd show up with everything but a guitar. He showed up with a saxophone. So,
you know, that happened to us too, actually. When we had Richie Kotzen, he showed up with a saxophone too and was like, okay.
Yeah, and what are you going to tell him? No, but, you know, you see all kinds of pictures of Mick showing up in the studio while they're recording, or, you know, when they're doing All You Need Is Love. And I mean, they'd support each other all the time, or you see McCartney in the studio with the Stones, you know. I mean, they were real good friends, and you know, they're still friends to this day. You know, you see them hanging out when they could see each other. They hang out. It's must be kind of a really cool but yet weird thing, you know, the lives those two bands led and how they're still around doing it, you know, McCartney and Ringo.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, really.
Now, the 1959 Les Paul Burst, man, this is like the guitar that everybody desires. And everybody kind of associates that to Clapton and the Beano album. How important do you think Keith was in that? Because Keith actually kind of did it first. He brought it out on I think, the Ed Sullivan Show and a few other shows first.
Yeah, that's a great question, because it really is true, you know, that Keith was the first guy in England to really be the, you know, I'm sure there were other bands that had Les Pauls, but he was the first famous guy that would actually be, you know, playing a Les Paul. Because as we know, they didn't make Les Pauls in the 60s. So, you know, it was a used guitar. He picked it up, thought it was cool, played and sounded great, most likely. And then soon after, you know, just a few years later, you know, Clapton and everybody else were grabbing Les Pauls and finding the magic of them, you know. But I think it all stems back to Keith. We were very fortunate to actually get the actual guitar and take it all apart. So if you pick up a copy of the book, we have a two-page spread, and we took it all apart, and we actually show the inside guts of the guitar. It's really cool. And you know, we took off the toggle switch ring so you could see the amount of fading that the guitar used to be, much redder.
Oh yeah,
it's more of a red color. So this, you know, for us guitar geeks, it's really cool stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the guitar porn alone in this book is worth the purchase. But you know. Yeah, that was cool to see that. I'm sure people that have, you know, examined bursts, you know, in person. It's the first time I've really seen a picture like that where they've taken off the covers and you can see the change in the color, which we all know that's why there's lemon bursts and honey bursts and all that stuff. They all were cherry, but yeah, it's pretty neat to see that. Who owns that guitar now? Because is it Mick Taylor or?
No, it's an interesting story. That guitar in itself is a cool story in itself. So, as we know, Mick Taylor was in John Mayall's band, and Mick told me that his guitar got stolen. They were playing, and it got stolen. He was using a Les Paul to emulate Clapton's tone, because John Mayall said, I want you to get the same tone that Clapton was getting. So he's using a Marshall, and he's using a Les Paul, but it got stolen, and he's like, you know, you couldn't go to the store and buy a Les Paul. So he's searching all over London, and he runs into Ian Stewart, and he says, well, we've got one. Keith's not really using it. If you want to swing by the studio, why don't you swing by, and I'm sure we could sell it to you. And he was in charge of all their equipment. And they were recording Satanic Majesties, actually, at the time at Olympic. So Mick told me he went in. He didn't really know them. He went in. They were in the other room recording, and he just kind of went in and looked at the guitar and played it, and you know, he liked it and paid for it. So, you know, then you see him playing it. There's pictures of him playing it with the Blues Breakers, John Mayall's band. And, you know, he had it. Lo and behold, you know, he joins the Stones. And he told me, he goes, the funny thing was, is I joined the Stones, and this is one of my guitars. He had that, and he had the SG, and he's playing them. And Keith saw the Les Paul, and he just took it for granted it was still his guitar. And he never knew that it was ever sold or anything.
Yes.
So Keith just started playing it again like it was his guitar, like it never went out of his possession. And then oddly enough, when they were recording Exile on Main Street in the south of France, that was one of the guitars that was stolen. And because, as you know, with the flame, it's like a fingerprint, you could really detect the guitar. So it had gone through a lot of different hands. It was up for auction. Keith tried to get it back, but it just never happened that way. And it's the guy in the cardigans actually owns it. So it's up in Scandinavia somewhere.
Wow.
But he bought it and he owns it. I mean, you know, it's a darn cool guitar, man. Historic.
Now, what vocal microphones did Mick prefer to use? What were the Stones using back then?
Well, you know, I mean, a PA system, it's kind of similar to it is now. Like if you're a working band and you show up to the House of Blues, there's my mic. All right, well, whatever. It's fine, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You go to the next gig, and whatever mic they got there, you're going to use it. It's probably an SM57, 58, or Beta 58, or whatever. And back then, you know, early days, you know, they had British Reslow microphones, okay? and the Resolo microphones was a common. It was like what we think a 57 is right now, you know, here.
Mm-hmm.
It was a typical microphone, little chrome kind of metal microphone, square thing. But through time, you know, there was Shure endorsements and, you know, I mean, but a microphone, it's like an accessory. Hey, you'll forget it, you know, throw it on the floor or whatever. I mean, you know, hey, I don't think they thought that much of it, but there was a time where Mick was actually formally endorsing Shure microphones.
What about in the studio? Did they prefer to use any particular microphones? Because I know, like, I couldn't tell you what the microphone was, but when my band recorded, we had the studio had the Beatles microphone. So I don't know what that was, but I know it was expensive as hell microphone.
It must have been a Neumann. Most people are using Neumann.
Must have been.
Yeah, and Neumanns or Telefunkens. You know, in better studios like at Abbey Road, you're going to see that stuff. When they recorded their early stuff at Regent, you know, I mean, it was not as equipped a studio. You know, they didn't have the same kind of financial backing there where they could buy the best equipment. But although they had good microphones, you know, you know, they recorded at Olympic too. They recorded here in the States at RCA Studios. So RCA had great equipment in there. So I don't think the band themselves, and this is, you know, they didn't really care that much, just as long as it sounded well. You know, they weren't that in tune to, you know, what do you want me to sing? Okay, over here. Yeah, great. I mean, I don't think they'd say, I couldn't envision Jagger going up to a mic and saying, this RCA ribbon mic is not my standard, so I'm going to have the Telefunken from England, you know, at the other studio. Now, you know, the German-made Neumann's going to be, you know, you couldn't ever see them doing that. Just as long as it worked and it sounded good, I'm sure they were fine with it.
Well, I have one more question before, because we're actually coming to the end of the show. Now, one of the other books you wrote is about the story of Paul Bigsby, who is quite an interesting guy, and that is a fantastic book that people ought to check out too. Now, how important was his early guitars? Because he essentially kind of made the first solid body guitar. I mean, I don't know if he necessarily would be considered the inventor. I know that Les Paul would claim that he was, but how can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting story. Fred Gretsch, the Gretsch family owns the Bigsby name, and they wanted me to write this book. And I was like, okay, I know there's the story there. But the more I dug into it, it was really an interesting story, and it was an untold story. You're right. Yeah, Paul Bigsby did design the first modern solid-body electric guitar. And I don't mean the lap steel, and I don't mean the frying pan where it's just a pickup on a stringed instrument. I mean a crafted instrument where it actually – I've played a lot of the original Bigsby guitars from the 40s that he made, and they're probably some of the finest guitars I've ever played in my life. I mean the guy was a craftsman. One thing about Paul Bigsby, he was a pattern maker, and it's a lost art. It's, you know, currently, like, if Ford needs a part, like, for a carburetor, they get on a CAD computer design and they do it. Back then, they'd write, you know, draw a blueprint, and they'd hand it to a pattern maker. That pattern maker would have to take the tolerances of that blueprint and carve it out of a piece of pear wood, okay? Mm-hmm. So it had to be identical, perfect to the thing. And then they'd have to do a sand cast and make a negative of it, and then so they could make the positive molds to build the car part. But it had to be perfect. Well, that was Paul Bigsby's profession, and that's what he did for a living. And it wasn't until years later in his career that he decided to build instruments. And the reason why he built such good instruments is because he knew the tolerances, and he could measure things very precisely with a micrometer. So that's why his guitars were so good. And so the story is very interesting, you know, and they're mid to late 50s, he's building these exotic, beautiful, you know, neck through guitars, really gorgeous. And Leo Fender borrowed a lot of the ideas from him. I interviewed Les Paul for the book quite a few times, and Les was a good friend of mine, and he would tell me a lot of different stories. But one of the things that unfolded were Les Paul, Leo Fender, and Paul Bigsby were drinking buddies. They used to hang out in Les's backyard in Los Angeles, and he said they'd hang out by the barbecue and drink beer and just talk guitars. And so that's where a lot of that information germinated in the late 40s, you know. So it's a really fascinating book, you know. He's known more for the Bigsby vibrato, but in true fact, his real art was the beautiful guitars he made. And then Another thing is, you know, his pedal steels. I mean, he really refined what is known as the modern day pedal steel. He did it.
Wow. Well, you know, in the Les Paul Estate auction, they sold an original Broadcaster signed by Leo Fender, Paul Bigsby, and Les Paul, which Paul Bigsby, I guess, delivered to him. They were trying to convince Les Paul to be an endorser for Fender. So.
Yeah, I mean, we actually uncovered a guitar that Paul Bigsby built for Les. It's a small-bodied guitar, and it's we found all the original patterns. He used to have stencils and patterns for all his guitars, and we found them all. And Paul used to label them. You know, he was a meticulous guy, and he kept, you know, pretty good records. Unfortunately, when he passed away, they took his filing cabinet and threw it out. They threw all the papers out, you know, so we don't have everything, you know. We found a lot of stuff, but we don't have everything.
Well, it'd be cool if they remade that guitar. It'd be cool to see.
Sure.
Well, Andy, yeah. We want to thank you so much. And again, you know, if you want to learn more about Andy, he's got a website, andybubbocksfabgear.com. And you can check out the new album from the Empty Hearts Band. And again, we want to thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, guys, and it was a pleasure.
Yeah, and just hang on. We'll, after the show, we'll chat with you afterwards. And we want to thank Reverb.com and Sweetwater. Thanks a lot, guys.
Next week, Frank Falbo, Falbo Guitars. Have a great week, everybody.